RUPSAC Committee on Business and Transportation for Thursday, March 5th. First of all, if you're here for Senate Bill 384, we're not going to do that bill today. We're going to move that for, ahead later in the month, maybe. So if you're here for that, you don't need to worry about it. And I will open up an informational hearing. We have two reports on TriMet today, and I think what I'm going to do is start with the one on pedestrian crossing safety, that report that is required by Senate Bill 829. Ask Mr. Hansen to come forward on behalf of TriMet.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Fred Hansen, General Manager of TriMet. Senate Bill 829, as just referenced by the Chair, passed in the 07 legislative session, required a safety study in pedestrian crossings on the TriMet MAX system. Obviously, we're always concerned about safety. This was prompted by a tragic bicycle accident at Gresham City Hall Station in 2003. To be able to accomplish this study, we contracted with an international consulting firm, CDM. They do work mainly around the United States, but also do it in other countries as well. What they chose to look at were 14 different stations throughout our system, and they chose those 14 to be able to make sure that they had all the different types of configurations of how platforms are arranged, what the locations are, how pedestrians are accessing it. So we really had a typical sense of what those stations were throughout the whole system, not just at those 14 stations. The report is there before you. I will just summarize that there are a number of recommendations that we think are very important to be able to be taken, and we will be implementing those over time. However, there are immediate steps that we are taking. In fact, notices to proceed have been issued for some of the work. We have parts or pieces of material that are a part of that, that are also under order and will, in fact, be installed as soon as possible. We are starting with that Gresham City Hall station. At that station, we are adding signage. We are adding what is called channeling. And let me stress this, because what's really important is if we can find that people who are near the tracks can, in fact, by the way we are actually able to channel them to cross, are actually forced to face the direction the trains are coming, we find that they are then much more aware of what is both a very large vehicle, but oftentimes very quiet, that is the MAX train. And so it's what we call Z crossings that are important. We are putting in additional fencing throughout this area. We're also improving and increasing the pavement, the special pavement markings that are here. We are, as I indicated, starting with as soon as possible with these improvements, as I said, first starting at the Gresham City Hall station, but really looking throughout the whole of the system. There are, in fact, 35 locations that are in our top priority list. That is 35 different stations where we believe that from that consultant's work, we can have improvements that will enhance pedestrian and bicycle safety at our locations. We are able to make use of some of the federal stimulus money that is being made available throughout the state, and we think that's a way to be able to jumpstart it, even in this tough economic time. But it's also, as you well know from the stimulus discussions, a way to be able to put people back to work here in Oregon to be able to install those materials. Finally, I'd like to be able to stress the legacy of Senate Bill 829. It's not just a one-time, from our perspective, not just a one-time study that is addressing issues throughout the system, but rather we find that it is a way that we're now going to incorporate a continuous review and a template for how that review is to be completed throughout the stations, all of our stations. What we have historically done is whenever there's a new alignment being built, as the Green Line is right now, that's along Clackamas, along I-205 from Clackamas Town Center on up to Gateway and then along the Transit Mall in downtown Portland, we always are looking at ways to be able to look at the latest design techniques that have been found either throughout the country or throughout the world to be able to incorporate. This process, really instigated by Senate Bill 829, is really having us go back and look not just at the new construction that's going on, but to be able to review all the existing stations and look toward how we can upgrade that. That continuous improvement process is one that is being incorporated into our reviews now and will be done periodically. We think that really is the legacy of Senate Bill 829. With that, there's a lot more detail, of course, in the report. I'd be happy to answer any questions or to be able to provide anything else that would be helpful. Thank you,
Mr. Hansen. I think before we do that, I think since Ms. Sturdy was the impetus behind this bill, to ask her to come forward and just go ahead and stay there, Mr. Hansen, and we'll ask questions together. And also I want to point out Senator Manus Anderson, who, of course, helped spearhead this bill as well, wanted me just to tell the committee she's in a Ways and Means hearing at the moment. And so she can't be here, but she's following it very closely. Her staff is watching this as we speak, and just want to pass on that Senator Manus Anderson is watching this that way. We'll get some material.
Okay. Thank you.
Sir. Welcome.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you for inviting me here today to testify. My name is Darla Sturdy, and I've appeared before this committee in the past. I want to give you a brief history of why I'm here today. I will review the safety study report, uncover the discrepancies. I'm going to show you a snapshot of previous studies and their findings that are 10 years old. Tell you how to reduce accidents at TriMet with basically no cost increases, and give you a framework for a citizen review board. My son's name is Aaron Wagner Sturdy. He was killed on June 23, 2003, when he was struck by the light rail train. He was a student body president, involved in his church and in school, participated in football, baseball, drama, wrestling, and in the Junior Olympics, placing fourth. An all-around great son. After his accident, I visited the legislation and passed Senate Bill 829, requiring an independent pedestrian safety study throughout the entire light rail line. We wanted to prevent the general public from being injured and killed. I went to a TriMet Board of Directors meeting in April of 2008 to follow up on this law that was passed in June of 2009. TriMet was given 1 year to conduct this study. The Board of Directors knew nothing of the study. I went back the next month and made them aware of all the circumstances surrounding my son's death and Senate bill requiring them to do the study. Thank goodness for people like Lynn Lehrbach, who is on the board, and he stood up and said, "This is unacceptable," and I give him credit for getting the ball rolling. The study was completed, and I was given a copy. First, I found discrepancies in the recent study. I have seen other studies that were given to TriMet, and they have not moved on them in 10 years. Cal Transit Traffic Manual Section 10-04 states that barrier and channelization is required within a school zone. This came from a 2000 TriMet pedestrian control warning and decision analysis by the Corps of Engineers that TriMet asked for. We have the Center Advanced Learning in Gresham. Their front door is only 25 feet from the max line and is unprotected. 500 students attend this school, and there is a law that states the school zone is defined as an area within 600 feet of a school boundary. TriMet was told in 2000 to put a minimum of barrier and channelization, and now we are told again in this study we need another study at this location. We do not need another study at this. We need action. I submit to you both analysis plus a letter and a picture from the school. I submit, which is in your packet. Also in your packet, you will find a copy of a 1999 poll taken of TriMet operators' opinions as the most dangerous TriMet stations. Center for Advanced Learning on Civic Way is one of those stations. Secondly, when I went through the newest study on page 4 states, and I quote, during the 2007 legislation session, Senate Bill 829 was adopted, which required a safety study of pedestrian crossings throughout the TriMet light rail system. The bill was prompted by a tragic accident at Gresham City Hall Station in 2003, one of only two bicyclist fatalities in TriMet's 22-year history with light rail. This is in your packet. When I first came to this legislation, TriMet reported numbers that were very different. I submit to you again numbers that prove the statement in the study is also inaccurate. The reason I'm here is to tell you the information you are given does not paint the picture correctly. Yes, there are only two bicyclist fatalities in 22 years. They neglected to say there has been a total of 19 fatalities. In addition, there have been 505 accidents involving LRT during the last 12 years as of 2006, 103 accidents that involved pedestrians and bicyclists. The year my son died, they hit 13 pedestrians and 2 bicyclists. If you take 505 accidents, divide them by 12 years, this will show you the light rail system has hit on an average of 3 a month. The report I refer to is TriMet's LRT report through 1994 to 2006, and this is in your packet. To be told two fatalities is not only incorrect, it is appalling. Furthermore, these 19 all share one thing in common. It is never TriMet's fault, and it is absolutely contrary to the National Transportation Safety Board procedures and to TriMet's procedures in their training manuals. I have had a safety expert look at TriMet's accidents and how they judge them. They will paint a completely different picture than what is being submitted to you to review. I have a copy of a safety expert's credentials in your packet. There are standard safety practices that are recognized in all forms of transportation. Therefore, I would like a work session to bring my experts to develop and show this committee the large problem that exists and also provide to you with an accurate assessment of these two issues. One of the inaccurate numbers and two of the improper use of standard safety practices. The basics of accident prevention are not being followed. This can be done at no cost to TriMet. We can prevent accidents if they follow the basic five seeing habits, and we hold the driver and TriMet accountable to the National Transportation Board standards. It is in TriMet's political best interest to say it is someone else's fault. This does not excuse them from practicing safety procedures. I would like to start the preliminary steps to form a private citizen safety review board of all TriMet's accidents so that this transportation committee will see the true picture. In conclusion, I lost my son. We passed a law for a study. TriMet board members did not know about Senate Bill 829. Lynn Lerbach got the ball rolling. The study is inaccurate, talks about further wasted time on more studies. We have submitted previous studies with no action in 10 years. Please require TriMet to put barriers up to make it safer for those 500 students at the Center for Advanced Learning in Gresham. Please help set up a work session and let us produce accurate assessments of the true TriMet numbers and accident procedures to eliminate others from being hurt and killed. We'd also like to start a preliminary steps to form a private citizen safety review to the board of all TriMet accidents. I remarked earlier in my speech about how it is TriMet's best political interest to say that it is someone else's fault. I believe my son would have said that it is in everyone's best interest, politically and otherwise, to be held accountable. The loss of any human life to violent means is appalling. The picture on the front of your packet is Aaron's 16th birthday. Aaron's birthday is next Friday, March 13th. He would have been 22 years old. May God be with all of you as you make this decision and look at this. My son had a saying, dream big, don't let the little things get in your way. To me that means, it's okay, Mom, you can't save me, but you can save someone else. Aaron's bridge to safety, that's what it's all about. I wouldn't be here today if I hadn't lost my son, Aaron, to make it safe for your children, your grandchildren, and really anyone that you know. It is your decision. What is a life worth?
Thank you, Ms. Turvey. I think my first question, Mr. Hansen, could you comment a little bit about the Ms. Turvey's comments about the discrepancy in terms of, or maybe just how they may be characterized in terms of the accidents that we've had involving bicyclists and pedestrians?
I think what Ms. Sturdy is referring to is the report of the consultant that referenced bicycle fatalities, that number is accurate. There have been pedestrian fatalities, in fact, 22 total fatalities, both bicycle and pedestrian, on the system since its inception in 1986. I don't think there's a disagreement at all about that. At least I didn't hear a different number. There are other incidents that involve accidents that may in fact be minor up to serious that are not a part of that fatality list, but certainly are available as well. I don't believe the consultant looked at that, although he may have. He didn't reference it in his report.
Yeah, because that's one thing Ms. Sturdy was referencing was the incidents, even though they didn't always result in a fatality, just the number of conflicts between TriMet and either bicyclists or pedestrians. I think it just gives us a bigger picture of why we're doing safety.
Understand, safety for us is number one, whether it's it has resulted from a specific accident, whether it was a fatality or a serious accident, or whether it's just our reviewing it and concluding that there is the potential for that. Mm-hmm. Everything from the review of our operators who see risky behavior and want to be able to say, hold it, something needs to be able to be done there as well.
I'd also like to ask you about Ms. Sturdy's comment about the Center for Advanced Learning in Gresham, and if you could comment a little bit about referring to what Ms. Sturdy said about, you know, this was identified a long time ago, and we still haven't got those types of barriers or protections or other types of safety figures, items installed there. Maybe you could comment on that a little bit and where we're going with that area.
In that area, we do believe that as that station is developed, right now it is not a station at that in that general area, when the potential for risk is the greatest. That is, people are coming to and from that station. There is obviously a crossing that is in that area that's used really much more informally, but is still there. We believe that the improvements that will be a part of that station development that is, in fact, having, as I recall, both Connect Oregon dollars as well as others, and will be completed over the next number of months. I think it's a bit longer than a year out. Those improvements and safety steps will be in part of that that design. In fact, we had a number of students from the Cal Center that came and actually helped design ways of being able to have that platform work and work very well, and was a part of their involvement with us. I do want to stress, though, that it's also important to be able to focus not just on the physical structures. Those are important and critically important, but it's also the education. We have, in fact, re-upped our efforts to be able to work with schools, particularly schools, middle age and up, or middle school and up, to be able to really educate people about what is safe behavior. We've given out, flashers, wrist bands that are, in fact, reflective, but that have safety messages on them, have taken our staff and others into schools to be able to talk about how long it takes for a MAX train to stop, that's its weight, other things that kind of start putting in as a key item the elements of safety. But so we believe both are very necessary.
Questions from the committee for either of our guests? Questions? Mr. Hanson, I just have one other. Ms. Sturdy has talked about a private citizen safety review board. Anything along those lines, I would assume, could be done if it was the desire of the board of directors, as TriMet could create something like that if they decided to do something. Has there been ever any thought about having a kind of an outside review of, as Ms. Sturdy has suggested, on a regular basis? Police shootings, and you have things where, there's a process for review. And
I'm not aware of any specific steps that certainly could be done. What we do think has been working very well is to be able to have professionals who can reconstruct accidents, evaluate different elements of it from a standpoint of experience that's across a much broader array of of experiences than just that one incident. But the concept of whether or not there should be a citizen review process as well, certainly that's something that could be considered. But I do think, I really do want to stress, that people who are in, involved in accident reconstruction, whether it be on the roadways or certainly for us, they tend to be able to bring a lot of a depth of experience and, in fact, concrete recommendations about how things could be altered. And we always want to be able to see that as a way to be able to improve safety.
Okay. Is Mr. Lerbach still on the board?
Yes.
Okay. You know, what I would, at this point, what I would suggest, Ms. Sturdy, is, and you have a good relationship with Lynn, is why don't you discuss that? Let's start there first.
Okay.
And see if Mr. Lerbach might want to bring that issue before the board and see what they might be willing to initiate and or bring to the table on that. And then I think that would be the first step to see what the board might want to do.
Can I ask him one question?
Yes, go ahead.
You were mentioning about handing out safety things to the kids.
Mm-hmm.
I was under the understanding from Steve that you've only handed them out on the west side, but it hasn't been done on the east side. So are you going to start doing that then on the east side also?
The answer is we usually did it around opening of lines when a new line would open. And what we really did, and a part being prompted, I think another part of the legacy of Senate Bill 829, is to say we need to go back and revisit those schools that are on existing lines, particularly the east side line, which is the first of the lines opening in 1986. So, yes, absolutely.
Okay. We would appreciate that. In fact, you might just let us know through Olivia or somebody when that has been done on the east side with those schools. Just we'll have some context for that.
Actually, I think we have already started it, as I recall, but the answer is absolutely we'll let you know.
Please.
Senator Verger.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I guess I'd just like to make a comment about sensitivity, not to imply that TriMet is insensitive, but I had a situation similar in a way in that the child was lost to the family. The Highway 101 goes all the way through Florence, Oregon. And we have a school crossing, but we have many, many pedestrian crossings, and it goes a long distance through. And the accident there was unfortunate because the child was blinded. He had a skateboard, going to cross, big truck, small car. Small car didn't see him because of the truck, and vision impaired. And those things happen, but the wonderful family waited 2 years, and I started helping them with one of the agencies and working with them. And the promise of a red light and the promise of some safety things sounded really good. And 3 years later, that hasn't been done. And so I just would just like to lift that up as a sensitivity when you're dealing with people who have lost a loved one, that whatever promises are made or whatever expectations they have. And I think that the thing that has impressed me both here and with the mother and father of my constituents is that there's been a period of time that has passed. So this isn't an emotional kind of reaction to grief that's immediate. This is a long-term, well-thought-out process, and I think that needs to be in consideration, too. So, Mr. Chair, those are just my comments.
Thank you, Senator.
As far as at Cal High School, that station has been sitting there for a long time, which is across the street, and that's not going to be done for a year or two. He did mention that at Gresham, he is going to put channelization. Could we get channelization there where you see in your pictures for those kids, those 500 students?
Yeah, I mean, let me take a look at it. I'm not familiar with what exactly is there right now, but the answer is we will absolutely look at that.
And okay. I can show you a picture of that. I got
and then, again, let me know what you come up with.
I will do so, Mr. Chairman, and Senator Verger also. All of our hearts go out to Mrs. Sturdy. I mean, the loss of a loved one
I'm
is
sure.
Incredibly devastating. I do think that the legacy of Senate Bill 829, really, which is Mrs. Sturdy's legacy, I believe, really is going to see substantial improvements in safety for both pedestrians and bicyclists throughout the whole of the system, starting at Gresham City Hall. But I am absolutely in agreement with you that
follow up, Mr. Chair.
Nothing can go.
I thank you for that, and I'm sure that that never brings a life back, but I do believe there's some satisfaction in being able to help others, and I would hope that that people are sensitive to that.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Thank you,
Ms. Sturdy. Mr. Hansen, I'll keep you here, and we'll go into our next report.
Okay.
On safety and security. This is required, colleagues, by Senate Bill 1074 that was passed during the mini-session in 2008.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. I think much of what prompted this was probably to all of us just a horrendous crime committed against a 71-year-old man named Lori Chilcote. It was perpetrated in November of 07. He was exiting a station or a light rail car at a station platform in Gresham and was attacked by a 15-year-old with a baseball bat and suffered serious injuries. First, maybe just about the incident itself. The individual perpetrator appeared not to in any way try to be, it did not appear to be a crime that was associated with theft or anything else. In fact, he didn't even appear to be trying to get away because he just kind of walked off slowly and was arrested within one block of the incident. That 15-year-old was sentenced a year later, 8.5 years of prison time. I do stress, and this is just maybe a commentary on the broader social network or the juvenile justice system and some of the holes that are there. This individual had been arrested 16 times at age 15. 11 of those in Gresham, 5 of those in the city of Portland. During that time, he had spent a total of 4 days in detention, and maybe more importantly, there had been no serious effort to be able to direct him off of a path that ultimately ended up in his spending serious jail time. It's hard, I think, for any of us to imagine that he's going to return to society as a model citizen. That prompted the efforts around safety and security to be able to be really up, and I want to be able to bring you up to date on the steps that have been taken, not just around criminal behavior, but also obnoxious behavior that oftentimes can become intimidating, even if it is not criminally a criminal level. We have installed many more closed-circuit televisions, and we'll be doing so over the coming months as well. Those are already on all of our light rail vehicles. They are at most of the platforms, and we'll be at a majority of the platforms here relatively shortly. Number two is we've altered our code of conduct. A recent decision by the State Court of Appeals addressing issues around not just what was said being protected by free speech, but that the volume with which it is said is not necessarily protected. This involved a lawyer in a courthouse in the Corvallis area. But what the court said is that the volume of speech, that is the screaming of obscenities or other things, the words and the contents might be able to be protected by free speech, but the volume was not necessarily. And as a result, we've amended our code to be able to have that type of what can oftentimes be intimidating behavior, particularly to somebody who is elderly or frail, on the system. And our officers, police officers, are able to address it. Number two, at the time of that attack in November of 07, we had 29 sworn officers. I think you may recall that they're not TriMet police officers. These are officers who are Portland police or any of our other jurisdictions that are within the area that are assigned to Transit Police Division. We pay 100% of their costs, but they're still sworn officers from the different jurisdictions. We were, at the time of that attack in November, at 29 sworn officers. Our authorized level now is 58, and we will be there by July 1st. We've actually brought in numerous other jurisdictions to be able to enter into intergovernmental agreements so their police can serve as well. That really is a doubling, will be by July 1st, a doubling of the number of officers on the system. Equally important is a requirement that I put in place that the officers were to spend at least 70% of their time on the system, on the platforms, on the trains, or other things. Our estimate is that they were probably at about 35% of the time prior to this in place. Speaking with Vince Jarmer, the commander of the Transit Police Division, just day before yesterday, they're running right at about 69% to 70% of their time, depending upon which precinct. We've done other things. We've established a West precinct in Hillsborough. We've established an East precinct in Gresham, and we are now having utilized, will be utilizing some stimulus dollars to be able to establish the South precinct in anticipation of the opening of the Green Line coming this September. That South precinct will be actually at the Clackamastown Center. Mm-hmm. Garage, right in the at the first floor, and so a substantial police presence as well there. We are also entering into a pilot with the city of Gresham, as Mayor Shane Bemis had urged, to be able to look at, can we harden platforms? That is, to be able to have maybe not quite turnstiles as a subway system, but something that, in fact, does get closer to that. That is, where the platform itself is required to be able to have a fare. That is, it's not just when you get onto the train, but rather when you, in fact, are on the platform that you must have that. That allows the our police or our fare inspectors to ensure that there is a valid fare. But it also means that we are able to better control it by fencing and various other things. That we are looking toward completing this summer in terms of that construction work that's there. One of the things that you, Mr. Chair, have been particularly interested in, I know, is the undercover side of that. We do conduct between 2 and 4 undercover missions each month through our Transit Police, and it has obviously been very effective. It is oftentimes addressed at drug dealing rather than necessarily obnoxious or criminal behavior. But it's there. I would also indicate that in 2007, we had, in terms of arrests on the system, just a little over 1,000 arrests. Today, we're at, or this year, 2000, for the most recent year, that is 2008, we were at just under 2,000, almost a doubling, a little less than a doubling of those arrests. Now, about 25% of those arrests are for outstanding warrants that have nothing to do with activity on our system, but by the police coming in contact with somebody who doesn't have a fare, they ask for ID, they run the criminal background checks, and they find that there are outstanding warrants, those individuals are arrested. We have also been very fortunate to be able to be a part of what's called Project 57. This is an effort to be able to ensure that troubling arrests do actually result in jail time. Project 57 sets aside 57 beds in the metropolitan area for certain violations. Interfering with public transit is one of those violations, and if an individual who has been excluded from the system for lack of fare paying or other activity that would result in that exclusion, if they come back onto the system, they are arrested for interfering with public transit, and actually are not just arrested and booked and then released, they actually are in fact jailed as a part of that. Our commander would believe that that Project 57 has been a very effective deterrent, and as he indicated to me day before yesterday, that if you are in fact arrested on a Friday, unless you can post bail, you were likely not to get out until Monday morning. So it does start having real consequences, and is important. Lastly, I would say, in terms of the police themselves, and I'll come back to fare inspection, which we I think all recognize is a very important element of compliance on the system. But in terms of the actual police officer ranks, historically, the Transit Police Division have had a predominance of Portland police officers and a sprinkling of officers from other jurisdictions. Now we actually have a majority of the officers are from other jurisdictions. And what that does is builds even more relationships with those other jurisdictions from which those officers come to be able to, in fact, be a part of our overall uniform security on the system. One example, Beaverton Police oftentimes have their bicycle patrols having nothing to do with the Transit Police Division. division, actually come to MAX platforms, ride the train, check for fares, do other things, which we think really multiplies our ability. Lastly, in terms of the fare inspection, we have doubled the amount of our fare inspectors to 30, all through a change in our union contract, a negotiated element. All of our people who are field operators, a total of 76, have the ability to inspect for fares. But by doubling the ones who are devoted virtually solely to fare inspection, we have been able to, in fact, see those numbers go down. The report before you, I think, gives a very good example or a very good description of that. If you look at the chart that appears on page 4, tickets written on MAX, I think we are beginning to see the effects of that increased presence. People are beginning to realize that the likelihood of getting inspected for a fare and having a written warning, oftentimes if they're a repeat, it will be a ticket or an exclusion, is showing. And as you can see at the last 4 months, we are seeing those number of tickets written going down, and yet the number of interactions we're having are actually higher, which really, to us, starts telling us that we're starting to turn that corner. We think there is still distance to go. I don't want to imply that this is, from the fare evasion areas, solved, but we have made a very strong and real commitment to be able to move those things forward. We do believe that on the system itself, we also need to prevent, not just enforce, but to prevent. And the Rider Advocate Program that has been operating principally within the near in north and northeast neighborhoods has had people from the community who oftentimes know, if not the individual, oftentimes a younger person, they know their family or others associated with them. They can intervene before problems occur. We also contracted with Victory Outreach, a Latino gang prevention group that has had a lot of ability to be able to, again, in the same sort of way, see people that may be at risk of doing something that is wrong or criminal, to actually intervene before it becomes a criminal act. We believe we need to address both sides, that is the enforcement as well as the prevention. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Yeah, I have a few questions. Going back to a comment you made a few minutes ago, because I was very curious about that, as we look on the fair side of things and that people are paying, and then you also have on page 13 the citations, that numbers that you've been writing, et cetera. One statistic, and I don't know if the officers, the inspectors report this, but would be really interesting to see, and you alluded to it in your testimony, would be the percentage of citations written per introduction. In other words, how many people did they ask, and how many, you know, didn't have them. So we know how many were written, but we don't know if everybody they asked didn't have a ticket, or they asked 100 people, because that would give us a better idea as to what is actually happened. So when they report, when they do whatever they do on a daily log, do they report how many fair requests they made, as well as how many citations? So we see a trend either way?
We have to do that by estimate, Mr. Chairman, but the answer is yes, they do. They also indicate how many times when they've asked for a fare, if they have concluded that it deserves only a verbal warning, or does it deserve a written warning. A written warning actually gets entered into the system, and the individual then is so identified so that if, in fact, they come up the next time, and the next time, pretty soon, officers start saying, hold it, you know, this idea of an excuse maybe doesn't really kind of hold water. I will get you as much statistics as we can on that. That is total number of people contacted, how many are in fact given verbal warnings, written, and then ultimately citations as well.
Okay, and then also in your report you talk about you are nearly finished replacing the machines, which is always a real issue if the machine isn't working, and it puts a real honest person in a hard situation. I got to go to work, but I'm going to have to go on and risk getting a ticket, and this machine isn't working. How has the reliability of the new machines been? Are they are they up to the standard that you had hoped for in terms of being able to maintain the fact that they're working on a regular basis?
Mr. Chairman, the answer is that the ticket vending machines that are the newest are, in fact, more reliable. But we've also entered into an agreement that really combined for us what were our ticket vending machine technicians. We had a special classification for them. But along with our other technicians that oftentimes came out of that work group, but were doing other types of equipment monitoring. We have, in fact, reached an agreement, and I really do thank the ATU for this, the Amalgamated Transit Union 757. We have put those two groups together and are now able to be able to have, starting on Monday, to be able to have two shifts 7 days a week, being able to cover ticket vending machines so that when there is a problem reported, we can get out there and get out there fast and be able to fix it. And so we think that both are necessary. That is, a better and higher quality, newer ticket vending machine, but also the ability to quickly respond when there are problems and to be able to fix it. Because I agree with you, it is very frustrating to individuals who say, I tried to buy that ticket, but I couldn't. Generally speaking, that's one of the reasons why the written warning is very important, because it tells an officer if this is, you know, the fifth time it happened, maybe you ought to be a little more suspicious of it.
Yeah. I have one other question. I'll go to the committee. In your report, you also talk about the ongoing discussion on Fairless Square.
Yes.
And so I was curious as to, A, kind of where that is at the moment, as from your judgment of that discussion. And as part of that, and I may be off base here, I know there's the connection that has been articulated before about the business district between Lloyd Center and Portland is one of the reasons, but primarily, at least originally, is more an ability of people to move around the city, you know, in an easy, convenient way. And I was just wondering, as a second part of my question to this would be, with the streetcar, which truly is just the urban Portland, at least it has of now anyway, an urban transit vehicle that doesn't connect to to Beaverton or Hillsboro or Gresham, so these would be people just moving around. And like your comment on if maybe the streetcar fulfills most of the original intentions of having a Fairless Square, where people can still have mobility around the city by using the streetcar without having to have the connector of a TriMet system that does go to too far outreaches and encourages people perhaps not to use the fare. So it's just kind of a two-part thing, where we are now and if you think maybe the streetcar is moving to a point where it might supplant some of the original reasons for having Fairless Square for the MAX line.
Where it is right now, we had a consultant look at the whole of Fairless Square, really looking at it from the standpoint of it's no longer a square, it's more like a panhandle, and maybe that's a
more pun, one way to put it.
but it has the extension out to Lloyd Center. By the way, that study looked at a whole lot of things, and I would be happy to be able to share it with you, because it tells you really who's using it, how many people are using it really, that are really only within Fairless versus they start or end their trip in Fairless, but other part is outside of Fairless. Presumably at that point they need to be able to have a fare. First off, that study has been out on what we call our open houses. We just have open houses where people can come in and really have a much more informal discussion. It will go to a proposal to public hearings in the next about a month and a half, and ultimately the TriMet Board of Directors will have to decide whether or not to make any changes. What has been recommended is to be able to have a series of options looked at. One is to be able to restrict Fairless Square only to the light rail, because once the green line opens, then you're really having both east-west as well as north-south movement in the downtown city area. There have also been ideas about whether or not a simple dollar fare should be charged for any movement at all. Should it be not on the buses, which obviously would still allow the rail side, or to be eliminated completely? That is something that we are still evaluating and have not concluded in any way what recommendation we will make to be able to take out to public hearing, ultimately to the TriMet Board of Directors. The streetcar itself today operates only on the west side of the Portland area, and parts of it are outside of the current Fairless Square, that is on both the west end up on Northwest 23rd, because 405 is the boundary. At the south, 405 is also the boundary, and it means then going down into the south waterfront is not covered. The issue around the Fairless Square is ultimately very passionately held by people on all sides. You get
really
places in Clackamas County, and they say, why are we subsidizing that? And you have people downtown that say, this is iconic, we must keep it. So it is not kind of with limited passion, and it was a lot of passion. The one thing that has been very important, particularly for the Visitor Bureau, they would say, is that without a convention center hotel, and therefore when you have conventions that they have scattered hotels in which people must be located, to be able to have the convenience of being able to access the convention center is very, very important, and that they think that that is what makes one of the real differences of their ability to sell Portland, the Portland region, as a place for conventions.
Okay. Questions from the committee. Senator Starr.
Thank you. A couple of things. Just following up on Senator Metzger's questions about Fairless Square and your just comment about the downtown hotels and the convention center. I've said this before, and I'm going to say it again. Free passes passed out of the hotels can accomplish exactly what they're talking about. You don't have to open up all of Fairless Square to everybody. You can accomplish what we want to accomplish with conventions in Portland by working with the downtown hotels and provide some sort of voucher that they could pass out to anybody that's coming into the hotel. That is a red herring, and I would suggest that you respond as such. I tell you, my constituents in Hillsborough, Western Washington County, feel very passionately about this, and there are ways to deal with that. And, don't look at my constituents to raise the payroll tax to pay for whatever you want to pay for when you continue to subsidize, these folks that are riding the panhandle. I'm not going to let you forget that.
Chairman, Senator Starr, we have, this has been a discussion item. What I relayed was really what the argument that's made to us is. We have said that, if you're at a convention, the ability to be able to use your convention badge or something else, the answer, the concern that's expressed is, but if they forget it, if they do something else. All I'm doing is relaying what their argument is, but I hear you loud and clear.
The second question, Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. I appreciate the whole fact that we're making sure all of the ticket vending machines are up and running. I happened to ride Max this week, and sure enough, the ticket vending machine worked really well. The reality, though, is that sometimes you get there and you don't know when the train's coming. And there's a line at the vending machine to get your ticket, and you want to get the ticket, but here comes the train. And there's three people in front of you, and there's the train. How difficult would it be to put some sort of ticket vending machine on the train so that you could jump on the train and buy your ticket on the train? So it seems to me that that would clear up this whole problem of people not having an excuse for not having a ticket. Put a little deal on the train itself. You can jump on the train. Yeah, you're standing in line maybe on the train for a couple of minutes to get your ticket, as opposed to missing the train, not knowing when the next one's going to be there, which is a point I would suggest at the Beaverton Transit Center on the west going west, that you put one of those little readers to let people know when the train's coming, because there's not one there. Side note, happened to have been there this week. But how difficult would it be to put a ticket vending machine on the train so that, you wouldn't have to worry about missing the train and catching the next one, who knows when it's coming?
Ticket vending machines availability to be able to be on the system is if it were just a single ticket that you were buying and everybody had to buy the same ticket, it's probably much more doable. The difficulty is we have student fare, we have a honored citizen fare, we have a two zone or a three zone ticket as well, and then you start getting it pretty bulky on there. I will go ahead and explore further that. Let me tell you from the enforcement standpoint, the one angst that they do have is that people will get on, and only when they see or hear that there might be a fare inspector at the next station do they then go over and buy their ticket. It's a balancing act, but I will explore that further. That's certainly one of the things that is at issue. The reader boards, by the way, are things that we are looking toward expanding, such as to the Beaverton Transit Center, and it does, in fact, lower that angst level. You can call on your cell phone and find out when it is, which gives you maybe some additional comfort of when that that train might arrive.
Except when there's snow on the ground.
Well, there might be some issues around that. I don't mean to be make light of it. When it's crowded, people do see the train coming. They want to be able to get on it. But there are times when I'm at the grocery store and I got to get to something and there's a long line. I don't get to walk out with my food without paying for it. And so there's at some level, understand, 50% of our people have passes, monthly or annual passes, or their employer pass with a logo on it. The ability to be able to order online or to go to a Fred Meyer or Albertsons or a Safeway and buy ticket packs beforehand, very easy to do. So we're hoping, and we can do it online as well, so we're hoping that people will actually get those tickets before they get actually to the platform. Platform's a great safety net for anything that can't make that, but we really also want to be able to see people get convenient ways to have it with them so they don't even have to hassle that.
Okay. Other questions? Senator Schrader.
I just wanted to go back to the Fareless Square piece again, because coming from Clackamas County,
yes,
I share the ire of folks. How much revenue are you giving up, do you think, by having that intact and in place?
We estimate that on a balance, when you have to take out all the, the things that, who decides not to ride at all and so on, it's somewhere around $800,000 per year.
And how does your fare collection system, I grew up in the East Coast, but don't tell too many people, I just said it on TV, there you go. And so I was used to transit, mass transit in that milieu, the New York subway system, trains, commuter rail into Grand Central, so on and so forth. And the collection systems there are pretty stringent. So what are we not doing? I mean, you can't get onto the subway in New York. I mean, there's turnstiles. You can't get onto the subway, the metro in DC, in Washington, D.C. I mean, there's places to stop you. So, I mean, what is there a design element here that we missed? I mean, it just seems so loose to me that it's worrisome, I guess. So.
I understand, even in places such as New York City, Mayor Bloomberg has announced
issues,
that he wants to crack down on turnstile jumpers, that jump over those things.
But obvious when you do it. I mean.
True, but it didn't happen. What light rail systems, and certainly Portland's been one of the pioneers in this, really is made light rail a part of the streetscapes. And that means that in many of the downtown locations, and very frankly in other places, Gresham City Hall is another example of it, although, and certainly Hillsborough and others, where the platform really is a part of the sidewalk, and Pioneer Square may be a perfect example. It's a part of the sidewalk, and so you can't really make that be a turnstile area because it's also a place that people are just using as for traversing. Now, there was a very conscious decision to be able to make light rail a part of the streetscape, to have it really a part of the community, not put it underground. I mean, it would have been horrendously expensive, certainly, but it was also a conscious effort to be able to make it a part of the streetscape. Numerous other cities have now followed that, and we all kind of struggle with that issue of the honor system. Salt Lake, Sacramento, San Diego, other places that have the system that's at street level and really part of the streetscape. We are looking at that pilot in Gresham, whether we can kind of harden at least some of the platforms. In fact, all the lines that will be in Clackamas County along the new green line, we'll actually have the platform be a fare required zone. And now that's not quite the same as a turnstile. It does allow a fare inspector or a police officer to be able to approach anybody on that platform and ask for fare. And if they don't have that proof of fare, they can receive a ticket or an exclusion, whatever it might be. So it's a bit of a blend, but it's been a very conscious decision, but it is an ongoing issue for all the systems that are really this type of design.
Mm-hmm. Other questions? Just while you're here, off topic, but you're here, so I want to ask you. TriMet, I believe, is getting about $50 million, is that correct? Round figures of, you know,
44.
A few dollars here, yeah, real money. Could you, because the committee is obviously very much engaged now in the transportation package, would you just tell us a little bit about what TriMet's plans are for that? What, how are those dollars going to be utilized?
Yes. First off, because of the nature of the federal stimulus package, the federal law, transit systems throughout the nation were, because of the nature of how formula funds are distributed, were one of the recipients. And very frankly, I'm very honored that that transit gets to help put back to work a lot of Oregonians, and we are very, very excited by that. What we are doing. And we have a list that's been published, adopted just this morning by the regional body, that is the Joint Policy Committee on, or Advisory Committee on Transportation, JPAC. And we listed all the projects that are there that are potential for it. We actually overlisted because we want to make sure that if a project falls off, that we have something else that can be put in. Generally speaking, they are projects that are to be able to address failing infrastructure or challenged infrastructure, also to be able to make improvements that we didn't have the budget for, but know to be very important. In fact, in Senator Starr's area, we will be looking at a what's called a pocket track, but it allows us to be able to turn a train at the 185th location. What that allows us to do is to extend the red line, the airport line, out to 185th, be able to add more capacity for people being able to ride wherever they want to be able to go, but in that corridor, but also to give a single-seat ride to the airport for people past or further west than Beaverton Transit Center. So that's one of the projects that's in. There are a whole series of other ones. I'd be happy to be able to supply a list of all the projects that are there if you'd like, but our goal is, number one, is to put Oregonians back to work, and two, to be able to make sure we're addressing infrastructure. I would add as one just a side note, one of the clear things that are authorized to be able to be done is to be able to buy buses. I mean, that's something that was a part of the federal debate. We do need buses. We are not buying and replacing buses. Our mechanics are doing an incredible job of keeping them going. But buses, as much as I like Minnesota and Minnesotans, are being produced in Minnesota. And if I have a choice, I may put those dollars to work here in Oregon for Oregonians.
Thank you, Mr. Hansen. Any questions for Mr. Hansen on this topic? And thanks for addressing it on the fly.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, on the topic. So the $44 million goes for basically one-time kinds of construction kinds of projects, capital investments.
There's a slight ability to be able to address out of one of the pockets a little bit of preventative maintenance that kind of helps a bit. In fact, it has meant that we not have to do some more serious service cuts in this economy. But the vast majority is against capital projects, must be obligated within 120 days and completed within 2 years. 50% of it within 120 days, all completed, all money expended within 120 or in 2 years.
So,
yes.
So just to follow up, none of those dollars could be spent for the, I'm forgetting the term, but in Tualatin to do the
quiet
zone.
Yeah. Actually, I offered the mayor of Tualatin the ability to put in wayside horns. Doesn't solve the problem, but helps address it. The difficulty with the quiet zones, although I think Tualatin is, I mean, they're the ones who are taking the lead, and that is the ability to be able to have actually those funds expended within 2 years, because the process is quite laborious to be able to get to quiet zones. But I pledged the $250,000 of the stimulus dollars to be able to help deal with the wayside horns, which could clearly be made within a year, probably maybe 13 months at max. So the answer is maybe, but it's tight because of the laborious nature of the Federal Railroad Administration approvals.
Any other questions? Well, Mr. Hanson, I appreciate that very much, I'm sure no one heard you identify Fairless Square as more as the Panhandle Zone area.
But we won't let you forget.
Thank
Only
you.
In shape.
Thank you very much, and committee, we are adjourned.
The Panhandle Zone.